Hey guys, it's Graham. What's cracking? Monday is in the books. They really screwed me on my schedule this week. I've got a bunch of very early starts. For the next 2 days, my route starts at 1 a.m. So that's fun. Jerks. Why would I need consistent sleep anyway? I was looking through my notes over the weekend, and I actually planned regular segments for the show and then forgot about it. Just because every day I get on here and it's like, here's Graham talking about whatever's on his mind, which is cool and all. Doesn't really give you an idea of what to look forward to. But I was like, well, you know, the whole point of the Radcracker show is an accountability of my progress and things that I want to share with you guys. I might as well stick to that structure. And so the first segment of the week is going to be my gospel study, you know, whether that's Come Follow Me or something else that I'm reading. Last week when I was working on Saturday but streaming General Conference like a good boy, I had just been given a free lunch by the restaurant I had delivered to, and it was good, hefty Hawaiian food. And yeah, they hooked it up because I delivered a bunch of their heavy stuff to them. Hawaiian food restaurants are like Mexican restaurants. It's like, all right, we want all your heavy meats. We want all the frigging rice. We want 5 gallon teriyaki sauce. We want all this stuff. And so the cool ones reward you after you lug all that stuff in for them. But I remember, like, as I got my lunch and I was going back out to the truck to eat it, this sister came on in conference and was talking about how, you know, her glasses were an allegory for the scriptures and how she always needed them on so that she could see everything around her. And, you know, the scriptures were the same way. She always needed to have like a scriptural, doctrinal viewpoint in order to clearly have a picture of Christ. And, you know, allegories like that, they're very useful. It's why the Savior taught with parables, speaking in ways that are relevant to us in our day and time. And, you know, it hung with me because of that. And then I remember getting on the Twitter machine later that day, and there was some journalist making a big brouhaha about, oh, finally the church has a black female speaker in conference. And I'm like, okay, cool. You know, do you remember anything that she talked about? Anyhow, I didn't jump in on that conversation, I don't think, just because, you know, journalism is a mental health diagnosis at this point. But as I'm going through and re-listening to conference from last weekend, the third one on there was that talk, and it was by the sister, Tammy Browning. And so I listened to it again this morning, and I'm always touched by testimonies of converts who were then given, you know, big assignments in the church. You know, not that other testimonies don't reach me, and convert testimonies and whatever, you know. I think there's something a little bit extra to those ones just because, you know, the ones that are so committed that, you know, they turn around and get called to a position of big responsibility, you know, to be an auxiliary leader or something, you know, that shows a level of commitment that the average Joe or Jane doesn't necessarily manifest. I'm going to flip that coin over right now, though, and tell you that, you know, it's not, oh, I don't want to go left here. I want to turn, you know, go straight. I want to turn straight. You know, there's also the pedestrian convert members that get up and share their testimonies. There was a family in my last ward that was, you know, from Africa. The husband had been here for 20 years. I don't know how much less time the wife had been here. I know that her English wasn't that great. He was from the Sudan. I don't know if she was from there. I only heard her speak English a couple of times. You know, but the kids are all super fluent and everything. And when that brother shared his testimony, like, I always perked up and listened because I knew he was coming into his testimony from a different place than I was. You know, I inherited a lot of gospel traditions by being raised in the church, and then had to find my own footing in my teens. But that's like starting on second base. You know, you have a lot of advantages. You have less to overcome in terms of values and perspective, you know, compared to somebody who's coming from completely outside of the church and changing a great number of factors in their own life to align it with the will of Christ. So, you know, whenever he shared his testimony, I perked up, and the one time he shared his conversion story in Elders Quorum, like, he could have heard a pin drop. You know, he had everybody's attention. It's crucial to appreciate being born and raised in the gospel, but I think it's also very difficult to appreciate that if you haven't heard the stories of people who were born outside it and had to find their way in from the outside. So I have a special place in my heart for members like that who share it and get so committed to it that, you know, they are given that much more responsibility. I think a lot about the parable of the talents that the Savior shared. You know, somebody was given five, somebody was given two, another one was given one, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they received a reward based on how they handled the talents they were given. You know, you weren't exalted over the other guy because you brought back 10 after you were given 5, and he brought back 4 after he was given 2. The point is, they built on it. You know, the Lord knows what we need, knows what we're capable of, and there are definitely people that rise to their talents, I think, more than I have, and that's something that I can learn from. So I enjoyed Sister Browning's talk, you know, with that outlook, with those glasses on, we'll say, hey-o, meta, he brought it back around. I had to dig around on my computer this last weekend as I was getting my videos ready, because I had to clear some data out of the cache, long story there. But I found a CD that I'd ripped to my computer way back in the day when I worked at Deseret Book. You know, I thought I'd cleared all those out. There was an employee library of CDs and books that we were encouraged to take home and listen to and read or whatever, so that we could, like, better know the product that we were recommending to people when they came in. And one of them was the CD that went along with a John Bytheway book called Isaiah for Airheads, which I'm like, oh, okay, great. Now that we're finished with Isaiah, I find this thing. The CD itself is only about an hour long. I'm sure it's much more concise than the book, but it's a lot of helpful tools that he provides, especially to students when he's a part-time teacher at BYU, as far as, like, you know, how to consume Isaiah. You know, understanding that he was speaking allegorically in a lot of ways, but you also have to have a lot of then-current events, you know, at the forefront of your mind for what was going on in Israel. He was 35 years old when he began his work as a prophet, you know, 740 BC, so a little bit younger than I am. Obviously very different life experiences. But when he gets into naming all these proper places, you know, John, by the way, goes on to, you know, make comparisons and say, okay, well, let's say that Temple Square is Israel in this allegory, in this metaphor, and that means that, you know, the enemies are surrounding the gates and they've conquered this and this and this and this and this, and they're tightening their chokehold on Temple Square. But the Lord keeps saying, you know, don't worry, don't look to anybody outside of me for help. You are my chosen people, and you got to have faith in that. Like, okay, you know, putting it in that context, obviously it's a lot easier to understand. I am in the 99% of church members who read Isaiah, and it's just, you're hitting a wall. I definitely need outside help with that. I do need to read more Hugh Nibley stuff. I need to make that part of my Sunday morning routine, you know, get up and read some Nibley, because he's the guy that breaks all that down and makes that accessible. So that's what my study has been looking like over the last couple of days. And you know, as I go through the conference talks, I need to take a little bit of time with a written journal and get back into that habit. Just take 10, 15 minutes and write down, like, okay, sum this up in two or three lines, but more important, you know, sum up your call to action. What is the challenge that comes from this? We were always taught that as missionaries. It's like, you can teach people principles and points of doctrine from the lessons and stuff, but if you're not challenging them or inviting them to action, it's kind of pointless. You know, faith is a principle of action. So there's my two cents there. Come back tomorrow for a reading update. Sorry about the tap, tap, tap yesterday. I try to get a good set on the microphone jack so that you don't have to hear that all the time. I went and played it back today and I was like, oh, great. That's driving me nuts. It must be driving my listeners insane. I think I also need to hold the microphone and not just clip it to my lapel because my shirts are noisy. Guys, I apologize. I am in a bad mood. I had a bad route. A lot of stuff went wrong with it. I should have been done with work 2 hours ago. And I'm in a bad spot. Like, mentally, emotionally, I'm just not thrilled with how things have been going. And there are a few things in trucking that are more frustrating than having a supervisor or a dispatcher who pays lip service multiple times to what your concerns are and then just turns around and makes them even worse. Like, it's hard not to feel like that's deliberate when it happens so many times. Yeah, we'll get you something, and then it just doesn't happen. Like, I spent 2 years grinding at my other branch, and then, you know, come here and just get kicked at. Very, very frustrating. Today's segment is on reading. That's another problem, is that I'm not really in the mood to read anything. I've actually quit on a few books. Not really through any fault of their own, I just didn't care. Like, don't force yourself through something if you're apathetic. Even if you bump up the speed on the audio, it's just gonna make you angry. Or at least that's what it does to me. So I punted on Star-Wheeled Sky by Brad Torgerson. It had some cool ideas in it. I just wasn't vibing with it. And I started listening to Frankenstein just as kind of a refresher, and same thing, there's some ideas in it. It's just my head's not in it right now, like for any book. Last night I went to the library and saw that they have signs outside saying don't bring guns into the library, so that was interesting. That was something I was thinking about while I was in the library. But anyway, I got a card and didn't check out any new books because I've already got plenty to read in print and on audio. But you can get music and DVDs, and you know, libraries now, they'll hook up to a couple of different streaming services, and it's like, you can download movies. It's like, it's probably stuff that was on PBS 30 years ago or documentaries. But their DVD selection was okay. They've got Zack Snyder's Justice League cut, which I wanted to check out, but that's going to be a bit of a project to watch just because it's 4 hours long. So, like, I'll get around to it. But they also had the new Batman movie, which I've heard up and down things about it, but they mostly came to, like, a net up. I just want things to be good. I want things to be really good. You know, thinking of Man of Steel and whatever else. It's just, can we make good stuff? Yeah. So I've still got a couple of other Halloween-ish reads. I'll probably start picking at October Country. I listened to a couple of episodes of Prancing Pony and heard those guys give their two cents on different elements of the Silmarillion. People who have big Tolkien libraries share pictures of them. It's like, oh, I've got the Fall of Gondolin, and I've got of Beren and Lúthien, and I've got all this stuff. And it's like, those are all things that are counted in the Silmarillion. But the standalone books also have like every other version of them that J.R.R. wrote. And I can appreciate that effort from a scholastic perspective, and I can of course appreciate the work that Christopher put in to preserve the various iterations of his father's work for future study. I just find value in the ones that Tolkien kept within his own continuity, and that's where the Silmarillion comes in, and my new copy of it shows up next month. So no complaints there. Still listening to it. I'm going to have the nice print edition for the library. Bought some books for my nephew. I bought him the first Skullduggery Pleasant and the first, oh, well, the only Supernaturalist. And then one other book that I can't remember right now, but I'm sure he dug it. It was his birthday. He's 15 now. Jeez, my nephew is 15. That's making me feel dated, kiddos. There's some other stuff going on in family life. Not my immediate family. I've got people in my familial orbit who are going through some tough times, and that's weighing on me. And it's a tough time that they've been going through all year long, and man, it's the kind of thing that tests the limits of your patience in a spiritual sense. And on paper, I know you're supposed to say, like, well, you know, the Lord does things in his own time. And I wonder if sometimes, like, his time is not meant to break your time. You know, it's hard to elaborate on it without getting into details that aren't my business to divulge. Just someone I care about is suffering, and it's hard to handle. But anyway, that's the reading bit, and I'll share something else with you tomorrow. No doubt. This will pass. This too shall pass, as it always does. Just sucks to be in it. All right. Suddenly, I'm out of the woods on the worst days of the week. My 2-1 a.m. starts are behind me. Tomorrow, I get another fiver. But I have to drive an hour and a half away to do the route, so I don't really know what to expect. It's in another town that I've never been to, because routing is really good at that. Anyway, I listened to a couple of segments of The October Country by Ray Bradbury, and they're stories that I have read. I checked the print book out from the library 3 years ago and didn't read all of it, but the ones that I read, it was like, holy crap. Bradbury's got a way of getting into your brain and just making you think of like very shocking what ifs, but it's not in the cheap and easy way. Like, so when people make a horror movie, there are two like easy ways to get scares out of people. Horrific, demonic looking thing, usually something that's got like, it's partially obscured behind a door or under a bed, or it's like a human all bent and twisted into a weird shape, and they're making the screamy, gnarly face, and it's just, it's massively overwhelming visuals. Or the jump scare. And I mean, those work, but they're also really tacky and cheesy, and it's easy to abuse it and overdo it. But Bradbury, like, his way of doing horror is just, man, like, he paints a picture and then he puts you in it, and I don't even know how to describe it. All right, so the first story is about this dwarf, not like a mythological dwarf, like an actual human condition dwarf, like this guy has dwarfism, who comes to a dockside carnival, and he always pays money to go into the House of Mirrors and stand in front of a mirror envisioning himself, you know, full size. It's one of those bent mirrors that makes a regular person look weird, but, you know, to a dwarf it makes him look regular sized. And there's the guy who's, like, not really the operator, but, you know, he's the ticket puncher for the funhouse. He's curious why this dude keeps showing up, and so he drills a hole through the funhouse and he's watching. And I mean, pardon me, but this guy's just a dick. And he's watching the dwarf and, like, making fun of him and telling other people about it, and ends up pulling this just this twisted prank on him by the end, where I'm like, holy crap. But then the next story is this guy and his wife go on a vacation to Mexico, and they see this mausoleum where people have to, like, mortgage a storage spot for somebody dead in their family. And you can pay to store them in there, you know, up to a certain period of time. But if you don't pay it off, you know, after a couple of years, like, they'll just dump the body outside. And it's this horrific thing, this American couple touring this mausoleum and learning what it's like. It's like, well, why don't more people just pay the whole thing off? And it's like, well, you don't understand it. To do that, it's like a year's wages, and so people make what payments they can, but then they're constantly trying to keep up with it. And then if another family member dies, it's this ongoing fight to try to properly bury your loved ones. And this woman is so incensed at the idea, like, she becomes obsessed with it, and she's begging her husband. She's like, oh man, promise that if this were to ever happen to me, like, while we're down here, you wouldn't you know, you wouldn't let them throw me outside. Like, you'd pay for the full thing so that I'd be interred properly. And she just can't get this idea out of her head, no matter how many times he reassures her. Finally, he stops answering, even though she keeps asking about it. And then she starts to feel sick. And then she gets very, very sick, and she keeps asking him, like, don't let them leave me outside, or, you know, throw me in a mass grave or a pauper's grave or whatever. And he's just not answering. It's this horrific, like, he's not answering. And by the end of the story, you know, it shows the vacation's ending, and he stayed a week longer than he meant to, and he starts driving home, and the passenger seat in the car is empty. And that's that. And it's just, it's so psychological and conceptual and disturbing without reaching for something that's shockingly gory or visceral. It's so much more unnerving than that. And it's the kind of thing that you can't fake. Like, you can overwhelm somebody with basic sense-based experiences, no matter what your genre is. But some things work on a very foundational level, which it's like fast food versus a five-star restaurant. Like, yeah, it's easy to consume and it's accessible to everybody, especially those who have a less developed palate and can't tell the difference or don't care to tell the difference. Like, it's the difference between a very satisfying, emotional, and soulful romance versus hardcore pornography, because they're tangentially related to the same parts of our psyche and our internecine functions, but they are not the same thing. And while a soulful, heartfelt romance can, you know, culminate in the highest act of physical bonding between two people in the marriage bed, and, you know, be satisfying on multiple levels, pornography only scratches a psychological and physiological itch, and does so very briefly and in a very unsatisfactory manner. And so you can create an entire genre of this thing that anybody can emulate cheaply and poorly, but there are very few masters who can tell a satisfying and deeply disturbing horror story, a macabre story, in the same way that there are very few of them that could tell a very satisfying and convincing romance. You see what I'm saying? One is significantly more difficult and more developed and more real, more substantive than the other one. And I just love that about Bradbury's writing. His writing was the kind that I didn't always appreciate growing up. I was looking for something that was more digestible, the kind of thing that's more openly recommended at the library, you know, something with colors and pictures and stuff. Whereas when you've got a little bit more poetry in you and you understand what he's saying and why, it's like, okay, I can appreciate this now because I have a frame of reference for it. I really liked his story, Something Wicked This Way Comes, when I listened to it one year in October while I was sipping apple cider and playing World of Warcraft in my apartment. Just because it was part of an overall ambiance, and suddenly I was like, okay, this is a little bit more immersive than just reading words off a page or listening to words through headphones. Like, it feels like it's more of an experience that I'm going through. It's a place that I'm walking through. I'm seeing these things happen, and I'm feeling what the characters are feeling, you know, based on the prosaic constructs that Bradbury puts on the page. Anyway, I'm going on at length about this, but I really like his writing. So, there's that. All right, it's Thursday, which means it's my Friday. Time to go home, be lazy for 36 hours, and come back here because this is what my life has become! Yay! I ought to just go in after New Year's and tell them, it's like, look, I'll work Saturdays if you just give me Mondays off. You know, I'll work my five straight, and it gives me 2 days off in a row. The freaking wheel is squeaking on my Durango again. It's always something. Tell you what, though, starting off every day with Prince Talk just reminds me to, like, not be fake positive or anything, but to just keep a perspective of gratitude. Yesterday I worked on the shop in the backyard a little bit, just trying to stay awake before going to activity days with my boy, and set up my marker board and, you know, just wrote a few things on there, and ended up writing something from one of President Nelson's recent talks where he focused on the word myopic. It means short-sighted. He said it was a word that kept coming to mind. And I think in the context of the talk, he was talking about, you know, keeping a perspective of eternity and understanding the purpose and duration of our trials and mortality. And I think that's always applicable, but I think in this particular context, it's, you know, I need to look back at the things that I was praying for in the past and realize that the things that I have now were the things that I prayed for back then. And don't be so short-sighted that you've got what you want, but you're only looking at what you don't have. You know, I'd like to only have a 40-hour work week, but make 150 grand a year and have all my bills paid off and, you know, be able to retire debts for my family and all that stuff. In the same sense that every Miss America wishes for world peace, like, it's a nice thought, but if you wish for a life without difficulty, you just end up a fat, worthless blob who never got tested by anything and never had to push against any kind of resistance and develop your muscles and get stronger and be chiseled and end up with a trad wife and all that stuff. So, keeping a perspective. Excuse me, I keep kind of blah. I think Monday night or Sunday night, I can't remember which night, I was going to go watch Charlie Brown with my kids, watch The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown. It's an annual tradition in our house, and I ended up falling asleep. But I won't have to twist the boys' arms to get them to watch it again with me. We got to probably watch another Halloween movie this weekend, too. I have another channel recommendation for you, and he's on a couple of platforms, you know, under his writer name, but there is an Air Force pilot by the name of C.W. Lemoine, or Lemoyne, not sure how he pronounces that, because he just goes on YouTube by his pilot handle, which is Mover. And aviator handles are not always like they are in the movies, where it's something cool, or, you know, here's your gamer tag, here's whatever. It's, you get named for something that you did or something that's easy. Like, I heard of a guy, his pilot handle was, or his call sign, I keep saying handle because it's a CB thing. His call sign was AIDS because his name was Aiden, you know? It's not always something cool. But Mover has been doing videos breaking down flight scenes from Top Gun Maverick. You know, explaining the truth of the fiction of it, mostly fiction. Yeah, but it's good, informative stuff. And I kept thinking, like, oh, this would be cool for a writer to do research on. Lo and behold, the guy's a writer. He's got a series of novels out there, the Spectre series. The Spectre is the call sign of the pilot. And it's like, all right, cool, good stuff. You know, he's got another pilot, an aviator. The distinction being that aviators are in the Navy and pilots are in the Air Force. They both fly planes. The aviator's handle, dang it, aviator's call sign is Gonky. So who the heck knows? But Mover does this series called Mover Ruins Movies, and Gonky and Mover have been going through different scenes on Maverick, and it's entertaining, and you get a lot from it, and I've been enjoying it. He had another old video that popped up in my feed today where he was refuting 10 facts from an article written by some dipwit in Salt Lake City. You know, the truth and fiction behind fighter jet scenes in movies, and it was partially, it was like maybe a third of it was truth, but most of it was bogus that this guy was saying. And he gets to the end of the article, and the guy's like, my name is so-and-so, and I live in this place, and I have this many kids, and this is my day trade. And yeah, the guy knows nothing about aviation. He just wrote an article about it, and Mover's like, oh, okay, cool. It says here that he's into cars, so maybe I'll just go write a few mechanical articles. It's like, nice. I love the sass. So yeah, check out C.W. Lemoine. I went and found his books on Audible and added one to my list, my wish list. Today's my credit day, though. I'm not going to get his book this month. I might do it next month. There was a series that I actually forgot about. It came out a couple of years ago called... I don't know what the series is called. The first book is called The Midnight Front. You know, dark arts, occult, you know, urban fantasy, but it's like warfare fantasy. It's stuff like that, but it takes place during World War II, and the focal character is a trench warfare guy who gets caught up in all that. I think I was looking for an Audible version years ago when the series like first launched, and I was never able to find one, and the library didn't carry the paperback, or they did, and I just didn't have time to read it. So I just forgot about it, and now it's all on Audible. So I'm gonna get that. I'll let you know how it goes. When I listened to another story in the October Country today, it was that one where, you know, the woman dies down in Mexico. Spoiler alert. Nah, I already told you. And listening to it again, I was like, man, friggin' Bradbury was thirsty when he wrote this one. It was like, every time he described the woman, He always mentioned her breasts, like specifically mentioning her breasts. You know, she felt nervous in her body and her breasts, so, like lying down, her breasts. So, like, okay, bro, gonna need you to downshift the horny just a little bit here. The story itself, you know, wasn't sexual or anything. I think he was just excessively focused on the femininity of this woman and her slow descent into aggressive preoccupation with her own mortality and her distant, emotionally unattached husband who didn't realize that death was coming for her. He's a masterful writer, and I have great many things to learn from him. So, alright, well, it's Thursday night. I might stay up and watch football. I don't even know who the heck's playing. Last Thursday it was the Colts and the Broncos, and I'm very glad that I stayed up to watch Smallville with my wife instead, because it was sure a heck of a lot better than that crap show game where the score ended 12-9 and our leading scorer was our only scorer, and that is our kicker, Chase McLaughlin. We all liked our previous kicker, Rodrigo Blankenship, for the Lego memes and the sock memes, but I think the initial warning of his, what the hell am I even trying to say here? The initial red flag for his lack of long-term prospectness in the Colts is that he was a fan of Captain Marvel. Anyway, he had like a 75% completion rating on field goals, or accuracy rating, whatever it's called. And I tell the guys, because there are still some guys in the fandom that simp for Blankenship, and I was like, we're eventually going to see this McLaughlin guy regress to the mean, but for now he's winning us games. And the ugly truth of last Thursday's game is that if Blankenship is in there, we lose it 9-3. So, Chase McLaughlin, AFC Special Teams Player of the Week, because he's out here literally turning football back into soccer by winning it with his foot. Not that y'all care. Love you guys. Have a good weekend. I'm going to schedule this one now on the drive home so that Ben doesn't text me at like 7 p.m. tomorrow and be like, hey, where the hell's my episode? Drive safe. See you out there.